Hey there, this is Paul Roberts of the Security Ledger. If security and the Internet of Things are your thing, I wanted to let you know about a great event Security Ledger is hosting on June 19th in Boston. It's the fifth Security of Things Forum. It's a full day of great content on securing the Internet of Things. If you're interested in learning more and either presenting or just attending the forum, text the word THINGS, that's THINGS, to the number 345-345 on your cell phone. That's THINGS to 345-345. You can also point your web browser to the event website, securityofthings.com, to learn more, to submit an abstract for a talk, or to register. Hello and welcome to the Security Ledger podcast. I'm Paul Roberts, the editor-in-chief at the Security Ledger. In this week's podcast, episode number 90, last week the Underwriters Lab announced that it had awarded the first Level 3 UL cybersecurity certification to a connected product, a network video recorder made by the firm Johnson Controls. Sadly, that designation doesn't come with a UL cyber sticker for the box. We'll talk to UL and Johnson about why. And Harvard's Kennedy School conducted one of the nation's first and largest tabletop exercises to educate elections officials about cyber threats. We're going to be talking with one of the organizers of that exercise about how it went down. But first, in something reminiscent of a zombie movie, news broke last week that the WannaCry encrypting malware was back from the dead and reportedly spreading within the network of aircraft maker Boeing Corp. But how? Wasn't WannaCry stopped cold back in May of last year when a UK-based researcher unwittingly tripped the malware's kill switch? Is the Boeing infection evidence of a new WannaCry variant that's making the rounds? Our first guest, Monir Hahad, is the head of threat research at Juniper Networks. He's skeptical that there's a new WannaCry variant spreading. It's much more likely, he said, that the variant that was spreading on Boeing's network was woken from a long slumber and began spreading to vulnerable machines on the company's network. In our first segment, we'll talk with Monir about how that could happen and what companies can do to protect themselves from ransomware and other threats.
Monir Hahad, I'm the head of threat research at Juniper Networks.
Thank you so much for joining us on the Security Ledger podcast.
My pleasure.
This week we saw news that some parts of the Boeing Corporation had a WannaCry outbreak. You're head of Juniper's Threat Labs. Tell us, what are we seeing here? Is this the same WannaCry that we all were reading about, a year or so ago? Because again, I think most people would say, gosh, you know, Boeing obviously has a lot of money to throw at information security, employs some of the smartest people in the business. How is it that they could get bitten by this so long after it first appeared?
Right. Yeah, when WannaCry first turned up, it was exploiting an SMBV1 vulnerability, which is called the Eternal Blue. And at the time, actually, it was also exploiting a backdoor that was implanted in a lot of computers called Double Pulsar. And at the time, the initial infection had one particular so-called kill switch, whereby the malware will first attempt to contact one website, a very specific website. And if that website existed, it would stop propagating and would do no further harm. But in the case the website is not available or has not been reachable, then it would basically do the bad deed. And one of the situations where these kind of things can recur in the future is, let's say, for example, you have a computer that was infected at the time, but the kill switch website was already registered, so nothing would happen. If that computer is turned off and is missed from security scans, for example, and is just sitting somewhere in a lab or in a basement, mm-hmm. Somebody someday decides, hey, it's time to clean up and let's reconnect all these devices, see what's on them. They reconnect one of these and it happens to be in an environment where it cannot reach the internet, then the infection actually restarts. And the WannaCry sample that is still dormant would think, hey, it's my time to be under the sun, and it'll start encrypting, it'll start spreading, and the whole process will start all over again.
Okay. So this would have been a system that did get infected, but never manifest, I guess, to use the sort of, you know, biological analogy, never had symptoms because the kill switch had already been thrown. And there was that researcher in the UK who registered that domain and basically stopped the spread, but then became reactivated. And when it went out to check for that website, couldn't find it. And so started propagating. Is that the scenario?
That's correct, yes. Your understanding is correct.
And this is an issue that I think a lot of large companies have, which is they have a huge IT infrastructure, both legacy technology. They might have specialized applications where they need to run older versions of Windows. Does that make them particularly susceptible to these types of recurrent infections?
It does, but in my opinion, I think some other phenomena is probably more responsible, and that is shadow IT. We've pushed security in the enterprise environment, at least so far, just because of the threats that we hear about day in, day out, that it can make life very difficult for some groups within the company who just decide to go about and circumvent some of the IT policies. So it is very possible that in large corporations, you'll find groups here and there that purchase equipment on their own that is not accounted for, not necessarily audited, not necessarily in the list of things to upgrade, and unfortunately just as vulnerable as everything else. So one of these systems not necessarily under the control of IT can certainly cause a lot of damage in a situation of a WannaCry type infection.
So we shouldn't assume from this Boeing incident and the others that there's some reemergence of WannaCry, that there's some new outbreak spreading globally. These can be isolated incidents without signaling some larger problem.
I suspect it is. And there is another reason why I think this is the case. I mean, right now what we're seeing in the malware landscape is that the threat actors are really undecided at this time about whether to focus on building and exploiting ransomware or putting in place crypto miners. You know, the revenue seems to be coming on both sides, and the exposure level is a little bit less on one side than the other. So, the focus is not there on purely advancing large-scale attacks of ransomware right now.
Somewhere in a conference room, a business development manager or product manager is making a pitch, on crypto mining versus ransomware. He's got a PowerPoint and some graphs.
I'm sure that's the case.
Last quarter's numbers. They're looking at last quarter's numbers. We also heard about an attack on City of Baltimore and their 911 system. Munir, is there a larger trend here of municipalities and local governments ending up in the crosshairs?
Yeah, I think that the threat actors are really looking for the soft targets, and they're becoming a little bit more sophisticated in that they're no longer employing things like a watering hole where every mom and pop shop is being hit or individuals sitting at home are being hit. They're really targeting organizations that they know are going to have a hard time making that decision of paying or not paying.
Yeah.
So it is normal that government institutions be in that space, especially the ones that have to deal with health and human services. So I'm really not surprised. And honestly, there's with the with the specialization in the world of malware, I'm not surprised that the people who are succeeding at this are still going after the very soft target that we're talking about, because they're not amateurs. They know exactly what they're doing. They want to minimize their exposure risk, so every operations that they put together has to pay back.
Is there a moral to this story? Is there a common theme or thread that our listeners can take away from these incidents, especially when it comes to how to make sure you're not the next victim?
Well, that's exactly what I was going to say. The takeaway is don't be the next victim. the kind of advice we give people, and we repeat that very often as much as we can, because we really want to make sure that everybody is protected the best they can. And some of the advice that we give is relatively simple. There are two key tenets to this thing. Make sure you patch your systems as quickly as possible, and make sure you have backups of your critical data. Now, the patching, I understand that it used to be in the past where people needed to wait when patches are deployed, because they don't necessarily trust the quality of a patch that is developed under pressure. And, you know, we've seen that very recently.
Like, yeah, sure. Meltdown Inspector,
you know,
right?
Exactly. Exactly. In those cases, it turns out that the patch actually caused additional harm. It actually adds to the fear that people have innate in them that something that's billed as a patch may not be as good as something that I can wait for. But honestly, those times are foregone. I mean, you can't afford having to wait just because you don't want to be in a position where you're applying a bad patch. Any bad patch today is better than not patching at all. So that's the number one rule. And the second one is make sure you have backups of your data and test your backups. We've seen many situations where people thought they had backup, and at the time they needed it the most, something goes wrong, they forgot some flag, they didn't put it in the right place, or they put it on a drive that's still accessible to the ransomware, and you know the whole thing goes up in flames. So make sure you have backups, test them regularly. You know, it's important to make sure that budgets allow you to deploy advanced threat detection solutions, because you can't just do this with like an antivirus on your laptops. These kind of threats can come in ways that the AV doesn't necessarily catch. So you need to have in place solutions that are capable of seeing lateral traffic. For example, in the case of WannaCry, SMB was really critical. You needed to have a solution that was network-based and that could see lateral traffic in order to be somewhat safe from this kind of an attack. Even today, there are tools that would detect WannaCry pretty quickly at the first instance, but you have to have that equipment in place. So, you know, it's important that the CISOs in various organizations get their word in the executive staff and make sure that they have the budget to carry out their mission.
Munir Khahad of Juniper, thank you so much for coming in and speaking to us on the Security Ledger podcast.
It's my pleasure, Paul.
Up next, calls for security standards to govern connected products are hardly new, but until recently, they've mostly gone unanswered. That's why I was pleased to read news last week that Underwriters Lab reached something of a milestone, level 3 certification for cybersecurity of its first product ever. That product is a network video recorder made by Tyco, part of Johnson Controls. In this second segment, we invited two people into the Security Ledger studios to talk about what went into that. William Brown, who's a senior engineering manager and head of the cyber protection program at Johnson Controls, as well as Neil Lakomiak, who is business development director at Underwriters Laboratory. To start off, I asked them to talk about what went into the Level 3 certification for cybersecurity and what UL's certification program will mean for the future of connected products.
I'm William Brown. I'm the Senior Engineering Manager for Cyber Protection at Tyco Security, part of Johnson Controls.
And this is Neil Lakomiak. I lead business development for UL's Building and Life Safety Technologies Division.
So we know about these NVR devices because threats like the Mirai botnet, both these devices and cameras, were targeted by the malware. So we know that these are of interest to malicious actors out there. Was that a driver in terms of Johnson Controls, you know, looking to get security certification for its products?
It absolutely is. You know, like you said, Mirai and a lot of the variations of it that came after, you know, went after, you know, targeted IP cameras and video recorders. So it was absolutely part of the consideration. You know, one of the other part of the considerations is, Paul, is that, you know, if you look at the physical security industry, it's still trying to understand cybersecurity. There's still a lot of places today that are still using analog cameras. And now they're switching over to the IP-based cameras. And they really don't even have enough knowledge to even ask the questions to some of these vendors, or much less make an assessment on the product. So UL is kind of filling that gap for us, is actually saying, look, we have a third-party attestation of the security of the product.
Neil, maybe talk to us a little bit about this level 3 certification and what distinguishes it from the lower levels.
Absolutely. So it's the Cyber Security Assurance Program is the certification program for products and systems, network-connected products and systems. And the program is based upon a series of standards. It's the UL 2900 series of cybersecurity standards. there's a general requirements document, which is the 2900-1, and that was the first one that we started with that intended to encompass really any kind of network-connected product or system. And over the last year or so, we've begun to add additional kind of subparts to the 2900 series to address very specific industry segments. So, for example, we have a 2900 document for medical and healthcare. We have one for industrial control systems. And in particular, for life safety and security products, we have the UL 2900-2-3. So it's very specific to the life safety and security industry. And that's the standard in which the Johnson Controls VideoEdge network video recorder is certified to. And in that standard, 2900-2-3, it is broken into three different levels. And the reason why we decided to address different industry segments is because they have different needs. And so in the case of life safety and security, the group of stakeholders that we worked with to develop the requirements around that standard, there was a strong need to have a kind of a tiered system approach where there's kind of an increasing level of requirements ranging from 1 to 3 based on where companies are in their maturity cycle for cybersecurity. So for level 3, you need to meet all of the requirements that are referenced in 2900-1, in addition to some vendor-related requirements, things around how the manufacturer is able to track and identify vulnerabilities. So these get to more the process piece, software development, life cycle, kind of quality management. So they're required to track and identify, communicate to the supply chain if there's new vulnerabilities that are discovered. You know, they need to have a mechanism in place to notify their clients and the proper authorities in the event of a data breach. And then also, you know, providing, you know, a commitment to maintain the intended function of the product over the course of the lifetime while still addressing potential vulnerabilities as they arise.
So there are a lot of different tests that go into these certifications, vulnerability scans, code analysis, binary analysis, fuzzing of the actual device itself, so looking for trying to get it to crash or misbehave, you know, and other types of penetration tests. Does UL do all of those tests, or do you leave it to the vendor to hire someone to do them and kind of present the paperwork to UL, or how does this work exactly?
UL has the capability to do all those tests. So anything in the three major categories of risk controls, you know, risk management, software weaknesses, and vulnerabilities and exploits. And Paul, I think you did a really nice job of kind of laying those out. So we have a whole suite of software tools to be able to evaluate across those different parameters. But we also have the ability to qualify an individual company that may have their own in-house capabilities. So we've actually been working with Johnson Controls for at least 2 years, and prior to UL developing standards and the cybersecurity assurance program, Will and his team had developed a cyber protection product security program. So internally, they had developed a center of excellence and really had invested a lot into cybersecurity. So we were able to leverage that and continue to do so moving forward. So we have the ability to evaluate and qualify certain manufacturers to be able to do some of their own testing, if that's applicable.
So, Neil, you know, with Internet of Things, you know, these devices take all different forms and shapes. You know, this NVR, for example, you know, functions as a video recorder. But it basically, in its shape and form factor, it's basically a, you know, computer server. Other devices, as you said, might be medical devices or potentially down the road, you know, automobiles or home appliances or what have you. How do you decide how to kind of categorize these different devices and whether, you know, a test for an NVR might be reproducible or usable for another category of Internet of Things devices?
Yeah, I think at the base level, I mean, there's a lot of commonalities across, you know, different network connectable products. Yeah, you're dealing with firmware, software, and hardware. So I think, you know, there's a base level of kind of basic blocking and tackling techniques that you can use that apply to most products. And then I think you really have to rely upon your subject matter experts, you know, your test team that has the experience, with the software tools and to be able to adapt to what they're seeing based on the feedback that they're getting from the tools. So, you know, it isn't a manual function in the sense that you run a test and it's a green light or a red light. You really need to have people that are knowledgeable in the space that can interpret the results that they're seeing from the different software tools and decide if there's, you know, is there a different method of attack, let's say, for example, especially around structured penetration testing. So based on the feedback that you're getting from the product, from the software tools, you can sort of change your approach. And so, you know, as you can imagine, you know, the people that do this stuff really well pride themselves on being able to break it, if you will, to be able to identify and find, you know, the vulnerabilities in a product. And that's what our focus is to really help our clients, you know, identify what risks they have with their products and how we came to discover those. And then ultimately it helps them with their software design and how to address them.
Okay, so some of the problems we've seen in the last couple of years around these types of devices, cameras and NVRs, DVRs, let's just talk about those and how these cap levels address them. So one of the big ones was, you know, either default passwords and usernames that secured either the NVR or the camera itself. Those were, Mirai obviously made ready use of default password values. That's something that's going to trip a flag in the UL cap testing?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, that falls, you know, very squarely into the risk controls and risk management section of the standard and the requirements that addresses things like access control, user authentication. So yeah, if there's a product that doesn't force you to, you know, reset your default password, then that would be kicked out right away in terms of not meeting the requirements. So that I would consider, you know, kind of basic cyber hygiene, right? I mean, really at the fundamental level, you really want to force the user to have to set their own unique password so that it mitigates somebody from being able to access the device. I think that's like cybersecurity 101. But as we've seen in the media, it happens a lot, right? People, like to connect things quickly and make it available and perhaps don't think about the implications of that. But yeah, that would be, I'd flag right away.
Another big problem seemed to be just in the firmware supply chain that, you know, many of these cameras and NVRs were running firmware by third-party providers, kind of downstream providers, and it wasn't totally clear how fixes would even really get out to the deployed customer base. Obviously, a company like Johnson Controls, that's probably not going to be as much of an issue, but how do these standards specifically address that issue of, you know, when software vulnerabilities or problems pop up, as they invariably will, how do we know that the fix is going to make its way from the firmware supplier out to the end user in some kind of regular order?
Yeah, so that is a requirement for certification, is that the manufacturer needs to have a process in place by which they are able to identify, research, and rectify new vulnerabilities, which invariably they do occur, as you say, and be able to notify their clients and the supply chain, the affected users, and what are the mitigating factors that they need to follow. So that that absolutely is part and parcel of the requirements to be able to achieve certification. And UL 2900-2-3 takes it even a step further and requires very specific things that the manufacturer has to demonstrate, you know, more from a process standpoint, that they have these things in place. And then they have the ability, you know, to push out, you know, software updates, once a fix is put into place, that there's an ability to update that product. So we look for those. We look at those processes very specifically, And that all becomes part of our report, our certification report, that they have these controls in place.
And Will, I know many customers are probably inclined to sort of set it and forget it, particularly with, you know, infrastructure like cameras and NVRs. You know, they work. Why mess with it? Has this or does this put new requirements on Johnson Controls to more actively manage these devices in the field and, you know, create systems or levers to really force customers to apply software updates as they become available?
Yeah, you know, it's always been a challenge in the physical security industry in general, because if you think about the way our products are installed, right, I'm not usually selling this to the end user. I'm selling this to an integrator. An integrator is installing it for an end user. That integrator is who's maintaining that system. So for me, it's even hard for us to know who our end users even are. I can tell you who I sold the product to, but I can't tell you where they installed it. So some of the things that we've put in place, for example, you know, you can actually go to our cyber protection webpage and sign up for these advisories. So if we do issue a security advisory, you could get that email and say, you know, is my product affected? So an end user who has no direct point of contact with us can still get access to these security advisories, and they do have a vulnerable product and call up the integrator and say, hey, come down here and patch my system.
Hmm. Okay, so it's a way to kind of inform and arm the end user potentially and get the integrator to do the right thing in cases where they might not want to.
Absolutely, right? I mean, for a lot of these, you know, a lot of these organizations, they have a service contract that may or may not, you know, do a firmware update once a year. How do you manage these types of emergency situations, right? How do we handle Heartbleed and shell shock? Well, we, you know, directly notified our email list that we had signed up for those advisories.
And do you get a little sticker to put on the hardware?
Not yet.
What? Neil, what's going on?
So, Paul, yeah, so good question. So today, the deliverable for certification is a certificate. And the reason why we decided to launch this program, more of a certificate program, was because if you think about a product, I mean, just take, you know, let's use like a, you know, a toaster, okay? So you've got this physical thing coming off a production line, you know, gets a UL mark, is deployed in the field, and nothing really changes, unless it's a smart toaster, of course, but, you know, let's just say it's a conventional toaster. The idea is that that product is deployed and nothing really changes. And you know, now that you have network connectable products, now you have the potential to really change a product, features and functions, address, vulnerabilities, address cybersecurity issues. And so the concern that we had was, you know, what's the meaning? What is that meaning on that mark if you have a product that is changing right after it's deployed? So,
Good point.
We have been wrestling internally because we've got that feedback from the marketplace and we're taking it very seriously. And we are looking for some avenues to potentially provide some kind of mark. It could be potentially some kind of unique cybersecurity mark. What we want to do is avoid confusion in the marketplace, right? And so so we're still working through the details on that. But with a UL certificate, Will and anybody else that is able to achieve that, they're able to market that. They can provide that information on their website. They could provide it in their marketing collateral, the material that they provide for their products, to signify that it is certified. So we're still working through the logistics and the implications of the prospect of being able to provide some kind of a cybersecurity mark.
Maybe you need a smart sticker, Neil, that you can remotely disable.
We actually have, believe it or not, we actually have a QR coded UL mark. It's called a smart mark. So we have kind of laid the groundwork for that possibility. You know, what we've developed with the industry is it's not a panacea, right? I mean, it's no guarantee that a product isn't going to be compromised or hacked because things evolve, you know, over the course of time. What we believe that we've created is an ability for companies to improve their cyber posture, you know, for their products. Basically, make it harder for somebody to compromise their product so that they either stop or they move on to something else. And so cybersecurity is a big investment for any company. And it's not something that you just do one day and you invest in it and then that's it and you're good. No, it's an ongoing investment.
Neil and Will, thanks so much for coming on and speaking to us on the Security Ledger podcast.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Paul. Appreciate it.
And finally, with the 2018 midterm elections just months away, secretaries of state across the United States are scrambling to get their election systems hardened against expected intrusions and other mischief by hackers linked to the government of Russia or other threat actors. One of the big challenges will be cultivating cybersecurity know-how within state and local elections offices. In our final segment, we speak with Caitlin Conley, who's one of the organizers of the Defending Digital Democracy program at the Belfer Center at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Conley was part of a large-scale, multi-day election security tabletop exercise that happened last week that brought more than 100 election officials from across the country to Cambridge. We invited Conley into our studios to talk about the event, what kinds of threats and attacks the tabletop exercise modeled, and where recently passed election security funding from the federal government may be best put to use.
My name is Caitlin Conley. And I'm one of the kind of the unofficial executive officer for the Defending Digital Democracy Project. We wanted to provide, you know, in the military side, what we would call standard operating procedures or these best practice recommendations, which is the playbook and should be the foundation for what these folks are doing out in the field. But policy is only as good as it's put into practice. And that's where the training component really comes in and is critical to assessing where improvements need to be. And it also helps, honestly, gain buy-in where you're making this issue very relevant to people who are involved in the election operations process. And not all of them necessarily are familiar with the threats that are out there.
Yeah.
So in order to train and assess those policies, you have to train and do these types of exercises. And that's where the TTX came in, the tabletop exercise simulation. We knew that we need to not only do these TTXs, but also teach election officials how to go back home and do this on a larger scale to have a bigger impact. And that's where we put together the guide that we released this week during the training event and our D3P Spring Conference. And it was really, really positively received. And from what we saw there, we already had states tentatively putting plans together to go execute. And a couple already had dates on the calendar for when they were going to go back home and do their own.
So if my listeners were in attendance at this event, which was in Harvard Square in Cambridge, what would they have seen? I mean, what did this event look like?
It was a lot of fun, for one. So they would have seen folks entertaining each other, really, with just how involved they get into the event itself. They would see that we had close to 150 election officials that were participating in the TTX components of the conference. So day one, we needed to provide a baseline of understanding before we could teach them how to run these events. So in order to do that, we put them through simulations. And so each of them were assigned a specific role, from Secretary of State to County Election Administrator to a precinct chief or a polling site worker to a county or state IT director. And with that, we crafted scenarios that tested the most likely and most, what we would identify in military terminology would be most dangerous course of action that the enemy could take or a malicious actor could take against the election operations and the entirety of the system. And so they were put through some pretty intense scenarios. We started the simulation 6 months out from Election Day. We ran through Election Day and presented them with a range of threats, both cyber in nature and other, and really tested their current deterrence posture, how they respond when an incident occurs. And I think the incident response portion is incredibly important because not only is that a technical piece, but it's also the heart of communication. How do you tell the public what's going on and maintain their trust in the process? So again, in the entirety of the event, emphasizes both protecting the process and preserving the public trust. That was day one. And then we did a lot of review and education about the different threats that they both recognized and didn't, and how we could be better moving forward. you know, the thing we tell them is we want this to be the worst election day experience they could possibly have. Mm-hmm. And that way they can learn from failures, because we're going to make them fail, because that's when you learn the most, and they'll be better prepared for the future. So day one, focused on that. Day two is when we turned and started the train the trainer portion, where we spend a lot of time showing them exactly how we put these exercises together, why we do it the way we do, and how to execute them to maximize training value. And then day three was actually presentations by students from around the country on different solutions for how we could help mitigate malicious actors from leveraging social media tools and platforms to spread misinformation.
How fascinating.
And this is a hackathon. Yeah, it was a hackathon contest we launched a month ago, and it addressed both the technical and policy components. So the state election officials got to see some of the creative solutions folks were coming up with.
So we know just from the last presidential election cycle that the intelligence community feels very confident that there were intrusions or attempted intrusions in a number of states, I think more than 20. Not a lot of detail known about those. How much was your tabletop exercise informed by what we saw and what we learned in the last election cycle? And how much of it was looking ahead and sort of saying, well, this is what they did last time, but next time it could look entirely different, and here's what it might look like?
That's a great question. So I think that the last election cycle made this problem very real for really a group of individuals, election officials, who some were already aware of the problem, but for many, this really brought it to light. And with that, it brought a commitment to doing whatever they can to improve and better security. During our field research, I have to tell you how impressed our team was with election officials out there and their commitment to really providing the most secure elections process possible. They are public servants who do the absolute best with what they had to work with. And it was really motivating for our team. Mm-hmm. So the attacks we put them through and the stressors we put them through, they absolutely captured what we know publicly happened during 2016, but also focused on the spectrum of threats that are out there, from individual actors to nation states, from threats that we've seen in the election sector specifically, but also threats that we've seen in other sectors, because that's what they have to prepare for. Elections aren't that different from other forms of network operations. And so they need to be prepared for really the various types of attacks that they could be subjected to. You know, when people think election security, a lot of times they think just about voting machines, but it goes so far beyond that. Election operations are really a system of systems. And so you have to defend the entirety of the process.
You know, we've read so much about foreign actor intrusions or attempted intrusions. You know, events like Black Hat or DEF CON come along and there's a voting village, you know, where people are hacking into voting machines. A lot of the news is pretty dire sounding. What is your sense, you know, being with these folks from state elections offices, on where we are right now in terms of our preparedness and how much people should worry about the hypothetical attacks versus what's likely to actually be a real world attack?
Well, first, I really have to commend the election officials out there, because the one thing that every member of our team kept saying from our field visits to every training engagement to presentation was how impressed we were by how seriously the election officials take everything to do with voting, the entirety of the process, and how committed they are to making sure that it's done right, to securing free and fair elections against the spectrum of threats or things that could undermine it. The professionalism of these public servants is something that makes me optimistic, and their commitment to just doing the right thing. And so as a group of people, you know, they're really incredible. They also acknowledge that, you know, they have a lot to do. And the threats are real. And cyber threats, just like they are across various industries, they constantly evolve. So this isn't something they can be static in. But but they recognize that. And it's a significant challenge. I mean, it's a significant challenge for all industries. So just like everyone else, they need to remain vigilant. They need to continuously improve and leverage what resources they do have to do the best they can. But it also comes down to they can only do as much as they can with what they have. And so some of that, you know, you saw the additional spending allocations that were just provided last week by Congress. Some of this is providing them additional resourcing to do more.
What is your sense about what the biggest gap or shortcoming exists as we speak today in our election system? I mean, what is the kind of barn door, as it were? I know that, for example, there's a real lack of, you know, information security expertise in many of these Secretary of State's offices, and certainly down at the local level, to monitor and manage cybersecurity around these election systems. But what, just having gone through this exercise, what's your sense for where there's the greatest need?
You definitely covered one major demand, which is the additional resourcing or additional expertise for cybersecurity specific issues. If they have more, they can do more. And some localities do not have the resourcing that they really do need in order to meet the demand. In addition, I think that, sorry, go ahead, Paul.
Nope, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, in addition, you know, so in our playbook, we put together a top 10 recommendation section that we feel applies universally across all election jurisdictions. Election jurisdictions in this country are highly decentralized, and we absolutely recognize that. But there are some principles that apply regardless of location or size or really systems you use. And so some of those things are pretty simple, but do take funding to get there. You know, having a voter verified paper audit trail. For some states, that means that they need to buy entirely new systems. But that's critical, because they have to have the ability to go back and conduct audits if things are called into question.
Yeah.
So some fundamentals like that really need to be a universal standard for what we have in our different election jurisdictions. But the other part is just creating a proactive security culture, and that's a leadership piece. And again, giving a shout out to Secretary Lawson and Secretary Warner, who were here this week, and Secretary Wei. You know, Secretaries of State are really leading the way in demonstrating that this is a public security concern and a priority for states. And so getting folks out there, taking the problem seriously, implementing some really best practice, just general cyber hygiene and cybersecurity practices throughout the state systems is a huge step, but they are energized to do it. Now it's about implementation.
As you mentioned, the midterm elections, you know, they're less than 8 months away. Is there enough time, in your opinion, for states to do these exercises, kind of get the results of them and implement, you know, fixes or changes so that they, you know, kind of improve their risk posture or their security posture before November?
There's definitely the means and time to do that. You know, we talked about earlier, cyber is going to be an ever-evolving threat landscape. So you're never going to get to the point where you're totally good, right? Like, things will keep changing and new threats will keep arising. That being said, a lot of these steps that we're recommending they can take are things that are completely feasible, even given their constraints, their operating constraints, both through personnel and monetary. But some of this is going to require additional resourcing. And so that goes down to state legislatures and other individuals who control local budgeting and whether or not they're going to prioritize these types of things that are going to help election officials better prepare to execute, you know, safe and secure elections in this fall.
So could you give me an example of one of the scenarios just that your participants were asked to deal with?
Well, I should say, in all the scenarios, we basically break down the election system into five subcomponents, and we ensure that we create threats that test the risk mitigation and incident response procedures for a compromise, each of those five different subcomponents. So for us, those subcomponents, we break down into the voter registration system and the voter registration database is one. Two is the vote casting system. Three are the vote tallying systems and election management systems. Four is the election night reporting process. And then five, we say, is external and internal communications. So that's email, that's social media, that's websites and other public portals. And so with that, we craft scenarios where there's different actors, malicious actors, that attack all five components of that. And depending on which system you're attacking, the attack itself is going to vary. So for voter registration databases, you know, one of the scenarios, we had an individual with permission to edit and update the voter registration database. They had their account credentials compromised through a spear phishing attack. And from that, the malicious actor was able to gain access to the voter registration database. And they manipulated a series of voter registration files that then impacted who could vote and who had to vote provisionally on election day. And things like that are meant to encourage states to take actions like implementing strong passwords and two-factor authentication and really hitting those points home. I think one of the things we call to their attention that they don't always think about is the importance of restricting permissions.
Yeah.
So if I'm an example, like an administrator from County East, I shouldn't be able to necessarily edit the voter registration files of anyone outside of that, like someone in County North or County West. But that kind of active management of permissions and privileges internal to a system, you know, revoking user access if they're no longer supposed to be editing that stuff, that those kinds of reminders, and again, that's like organizational management policies.
Yeah.
That's stuff they can do tomorrow.
Yeah. You know, the Congress just passed a big budget and has a lot of money for election security. So many of these jurisdictions, many of these states are now able to put in requests for federal funding to address specifically cybersecurity of elections. So that's good news. If you had to advise them, and I don't know if this was one of the conversations that was taking place at the event, as to how to get the biggest bang for your buck or what that money should go to first, what would you recommend?
So that's tough because, again, there's so much variation depending on which voting jurisdiction or election jurisdiction and how their systems are. But I will say the things that we really, really harp on and that we think are feasible for most jurisdictions to implement, and if not, they need to be, you know, banging the drum until they can. Two-factor authentication for logging onto official systems. Like, this should be a no-brainer. That must happen. And then the other part is getting to the point where, again, the voter verified paper audit trail, that should be the norm. Now, I know that, yes, Congress just, you know, provided another allotment of funds to help improve the process. That's not going to be enough for all the states that do not have that paper audit trail capability to transition.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't say that this has solved the entirety of the problem. You know, there's still more to do. This is a step in the right direction. Absolutely. And it's going to help. But there's still some big issues out there that we haven't addressed yet.
Caitlin Conley of the Harvard Kennedy School's Belfer Center and the Defending Digital Democracy Project, thank you so much for coming on and speaking to us on the Security Ledger podcast.
Thank you so much for your time, Paul. It was a pleasure.